denial of our emotions isn't the only danger we face when we rely too heavily on our left brain. We can also become too literal, leaving us without a sense of perspective, where we miss the meaning that comes from putting things in context, a specialty of the right brain. This is part of what causes your 8-year-old to become defensive and angry sometimes when you innocently joke around with her. Remember that the right brain is in charge of reading nonverbal cues. So, especially if she's tired or moody, she might focus only on your words and miss your playful tone of voice and the wink that went with it. I recently witnessed a funny example of what can happen when the literal left brain takes over too much. When my youngest son turned 1, I ordered his cake from a local grocery store. I requested a cupcake cake, which is a group of cupcakes frosted to look like one big cake. When I placed the order, I asked the decorator to write my son's name, JP, on the cupcakes. Unfortunately, when I picked up the cake before the party, I immediately noticed a problem that demonstrates what can happen when a person becomes too left-brain literal. There was nothing written on the individual cupcakes, but on the cake itself were the words JP on the cupcakes. Exactly what I'd asked for, but not exactly what I'd intended. The goal then is to help our kids learn to use both sides of the brain together, to integrate the left and right hemispheres. Remember the river of well-being discussed earlier, with chaos as one bank and rigidity as the other? We defined mental health as remaining in the harmonious flow between these two extremes. By helping our kids connect left and right, we give them a better chance of avoiding the banks of chaos and rigidity and of living in the flexible current of mental health and happiness. Integrating the left brain with the right helps to keep children from floating too close to one bank or the other. When the raw emotions in their right brain are not combined with the logic of the left, they will be like Katie, floating too close to the bank of chaos. That means we need to help them bring in the left brain to get some perspective and handle their emotions in a positive way. Likewise, if they're denying their emotions and retreating to the left, as Amanda was doing, they're hugging the bank of rigidity. In that case, we need to help them bring in more of the right brain so they can be open to new input and experiences. So how do we promote horizontal integration in our child's brain? Here are 2 strategies you can use right away when integration opportunities arise in your family. By using these techniques, you'll be taking immediate steps toward integrating the left and right hemispheres of your child's brain. What you can do: helping your child work from both sides of the brain. Whole brain strategy number 1, connect and redirect, surfing emotional waves. One night, my 7-year-old son reappeared in the living room shortly after going to bed, explaining that he couldn't sleep. He was clearly upset and explained, "I'm mad that you never leave me a note in the middle of the night." Surprised at this unusual outburst, I replied, "I didn't know you wanted me to." His response was to unleash a whole litany of rapid-fire complaints. "You never do anything nice for me, and I'm mad because my birthday isn't for 10 more months, and I hate homework." Logical? No. Familiar? Yes. All parents experience times when their children say things and get upset about issues that don't seem to make sense. An encounter like this can be frustrating, especially when you expect your child to be old enough to act rationally and hold a logical conversation. All of a sudden, though, he becomes upset about something ridiculous, and it seems that absolutely no amount of reasoning on your part will help. Based on our knowledge of the two sides of the brain, we know that my son was experiencing big waves of right brain emotions without much left brain logical balance. At a moment like this, one of the least effective things I could do would be to jump right in and defend myself. Of course I do nice things for you. Or to argue with my son about his faulty logic. There's nothing I can do about making your birthday come sooner. As for the homework, that's just something you've got to do. This type of left-brain logical response would hit an unreceptive right-brain brick wall and create a gulf between us. After all, his logical left brain was nowhere to be found at that moment. So had I responded with my left, my son would have felt like I didn't understand him or care about his feelings. He was in a right brain, non-rational, emotional flood, and a left brain response would have been a lose-lose approach. Even though it was practically automatic and very tempting to ask him, "What are you talking about?" or to tell him to go back to bed immediately, I stopped myself. Instead, I used the connect and redirect technique. I pulled him close, rubbed his back, and with a nurturing tone of voice said, "Sometimes it's just really hard, isn't it? I would never forget about you. You are always in my mind, and I always want you to know how special you are to me." I held him while he explained that he sometimes feels that his younger brother gets more of my attention, and that homework takes too much of his free time. As he spoke, I could feel him relax and soften. He felt heard and cared for. Then I briefly addressed the specific issues he had brought up, since he was now more receptive to problem-solving and planning, and we agreed to talk more in the morning. In a moment like this, parents wonder whether their child is really in need or just trying to stall bedtime. Whole brain parenting doesn't mean letting yourself be manipulated or reinforcing bad behavior. On the contrary, by understanding how your child's brain works, you can create cooperation much more quickly and often with far less drama. In this case, because I understood what was happening in my son's brain, I saw that the most effective response was to connect with his right brain. I listened to him and comforted him, using my own right brain. And in less than 5 minutes, he was back in bed. If, on the other hand, I had played the heavy and come down hard on him for getting out of bed, using left brain logic and the letter of the law, we would have both become increasingly upset, and it would have been a lot more than 5 minutes before he calmed down enough to sleep. More important, my response was more caring and nurturing. Even though my son's issues seemed silly and perhaps illogical to me, he genuinely felt that these things weren't fair and that he had legitimate complaints. By connecting with him, right brain to right brain, I was able to communicate that I was tuned in to how he was feeling. Even if he was stalling, this right brain response was the most effective approach, since it let me not only meet his need for connection, but also redirect him to bed more quickly. Instead of fighting against the huge waves of his emotional flood, I surfed them by responding to his right brain. This story points out an important insight. When a child is upset, logic often won't work until we have responded to the right brain's emotional needs. We call this emotional connection attunement, which is how we connect deeply with another person and allow them to feel felt. When a parent and child are tuned into each other, they experience a sense of joining together. My approach with my son is one that we call the connect and redirect method, and it begins with helping our kids feel felt before we try to solve problems or address the situation logically. Here's how it works.
Step 1. Connect with the right. In our society, we're trained to work things out using our words and our logic. But when your 4-year-old is absolutely furious because he can't walk on the ceiling like Spider-Man, as Tina's son once was, that's probably not the best time to give him an introductory lesson in the laws of physics. Or when your 11-year-old is feeling hurt because it seems that his sister is receiving preferential treatment, as my son felt on occasion, the appropriate response isn't to get out a scorecard showing that you reprimand each of your children in equal measure. Instead, we can use these opportunities to realize that at these moments, logic is not our primary vehicle for bringing some sort of sanity to the conversation. Seems counterintuitive, doesn't it? It's also crucial to keep in mind that no matter how nonsensical and frustrating our child's feelings may seem to us, they are real and important to our child. It's vital that we treat them as such in our response. During Tina's conversation with her son, she appealed to his right brain by acknowledging his feelings. She also used nonverbal signals like physical touch, empathetic facial expressions, a nurturing tone of voice, and non-judgmental listening. In other words, she used her right brain to connect and communicate with his right brain. This right-to-right attunement helped bring his brain into balance, or into a more integrated state. Then she could begin to appeal to her son's left brain and address the specific issues he had raised. In other words, then it was time for step two, which helps to integrate the left and the right. Step two, redirect with the left. After responding with the right, Tina could then redirect with the left. She could redirect him by logically explaining how hard she works to be fair, by promising to leave a note while he slept, and by strategizing with him about his next birthday and about how to make homework more fun. They did some of this that night, but most of it came the following day. Once she had connected with him right brain to right brain, it was much easier to connect left to left and deal with the issues in a rational manner. By first connecting with his right brain, she could then redirect with the left brain through logical explanation and planning, which required that his left hemisphere join the conversation. This approach allowed him to use both sides of his brain in an integrated, coordinated way. We're not saying that connect and redirect will always do the trick. After all, there are times when a child is simply past the point of no return, and the emotional waves just need to crash until the storm passes. Or the child may simply need to eat or get some sleep. Like Tina, you might decide to wait until your child is in a more integrated state of mind to talk logically with him about his feelings and behaviors. We're also not recommending permissiveness or letting your boundaries slide simply because a child isn't thinking logically. Rules about respect and behavior aren't thrown out the window simply because a child's left hemisphere is disengaged. For example, whatever behavior is inappropriate in your family, being disrespectful, hurting someone, throwing things, should remain off limits even in moments of high emotion. You may need to stop destructive behavior and remove your child from the situation before you begin to connect and redirect. But with the whole brain approach, we understand that it's generally a good idea to discuss misbehavior and its consequences after the child has calmed down, since moments of emotional flooding are not the best times for lessons to be learned. A child can be much more receptive once the left brain is working again, and discipline can therefore be much more effective. It's as if you are a lifeguard who swims out, puts your arms around your child, and helps him to shore before telling him not to swim out so far next time. The key here is that when your child is drowning in a right brain emotional flood, you'll do yourself and your child a big favor if you connect before you redirect. This approach can be a life preserver that helps keep your child's head above water and keeps you from being pulled under along with him.
Whole brain strategy number two. Name it to tame it. Telling stories to calm big emotions. A toddler falls and scrapes an elbow. A kindergartner loses a beloved pet. A fifth grader faces a bully at school. When a child experiences painful, disappointing, or scary moments, it can be overwhelming, with big emotions and bodily sensations flooding the right brain. When this happens, we as parents can help bring the left hemisphere into the picture so that the child can begin to understand what's happening. One of the best ways to promote this type of integration is to help retell the story of the frightening or painful experience. Bella, for instance, was 9 years old when the toilet overflowed when she flushed, and the experience of watching the water rise and pour onto the floor left her unwilling and practically unable to flush the toilet afterward. When Bella's father, Doug, learned about the name-it-to-tame-it technique, he sat down with his daughter and retold the story of the time the toilet overflowed. He allowed her to tell as much of the story as she could and helped to fill in the details, including the lingering fear she had felt about flushing since that experience. After retelling the story several times, Bella's fears lessened and eventually went away. Why was retelling the story so effective? Essentially, what Doug did was to help his daughter bring her left brain and her right brain together so she could make sense of what had happened. When she talked through the moment the water had started spilling on the floor and how she'd felt worried and afraid, her two hemispheres were working together in an integrated way. She engaged her left brain by putting the details in order and the experience into words, and then brought in her right brain by revisiting the emotions she felt. In this way, Doug helped his daughter name her fears and emotions so that she could then tame them. There may be times when our kids won't want to tell the story when we ask them to. We need to respect their desires about how and when to talk, especially because pressuring them to share will only backfire. Think about the times you prefer solitude and don't feel like talking. Does prodding ever entice you to talk and share your inner feelings? Instead, we can gently encourage them by beginning the story and asking them to fill in the details. And if they're not interested, we can give them space and talk later. Your child is more likely to be responsive if you are strategic about when you initiate this type of conversation. Make sure you are both in a good frame of mind. Seasoned parents and child therapists will also tell you that some of the best conversations with children take place while something else is happening. Children are much more apt to share and talk while building something, playing cards, or riding in the car than when you sit down and look them right in the face and ask them to open up. Another approach you can take if your child doesn't feel like talking is to ask her to draw a picture of the event, or if she's old enough, write about it. If you sense that she is reluctant to talk to you, encourage her to talk to someone else, a friend, another adult, or even a sibling who will be a good listener. Parents know how powerful storytelling can be when it comes to distracting their kids or calming them down, but most people don't realize the science behind this powerful force. The right side of our brain processes our emotions and autobiographical memories, but our left side is what makes sense of these feelings and recollections. Healing from a difficult experience emerges when the left side works with the right to tell our life stories. When children learn to pay attention to and share their own stories, they can respond in healthy ways to everything from a scraped elbow to a major loss or trauma. What kids often need, especially when they experience strong emotions, is to have someone help them use their left brain to make sense of what's going on, to put things in order, and to name these big and scary right brain feelings so they can deal with them effectively. This is what storytelling does. It allows us to understand ourselves and our world by using both our left and right hemispheres together. To tell a story that makes sense, the left brain must put things in order using words and logic. The right brain contributes the bodily sensations, raw emotions, and personal memories so we can see the whole picture and communicate our experience. This is the scientific explanation behind why journaling and talking about a difficult event can be so powerful in helping us heal. In fact, research shows that merely assigning a name or label to what we feel literally calms down the activity of the emotional circuitry in the right hemisphere. For this same reason, it's important for kids of all ages to tell their stories, as it helps them try to understand their emotions and the events that occur in their lives. Sometimes parents avoid talking about upsetting experiences, thinking that doing so will reinforce their children's pain or make things worse. Actually, telling the story is often exactly what children need, both to make sense of the event and to move on to a place where they can feel better about what happened. Remember Mariana's son Marco from the Iawuwu story in Chapter 1? The drive to understand why things happen to us is so strong that the brain will continue to try making sense of an experience until it succeeds. As parents, we can help this process along through storytelling. That's what Thomas did with Katie, the preschooler who was screaming about dying if her father left her at school. Even though he felt frustrated with the situation, he resisted the urge to dismiss and deny Katie's experiences. Because of what he had learned, he recognized that his daughter's brain was linking several events together: being dropped off at school, getting sick, having her father leave, and feeling afraid. As a result, when it came time to pack up and go to school, her brain and body started telling her, "Bad idea. School equals feeling sick, equals dad gone, equals afraid." From that perspective, it made sense that she didn't want to go to school. Realizing this, Thomas used his knowledge about the brain's two hemispheres. He knew that small children, like Katie, are typically right hemisphere dominant and haven't mastered their ability to use logic and words to express feelings. Katie felt the strong emotions, but she wasn't able to understand and communicate them clearly. As a result, they had become overpowering. He also knew that autobiographical memory is stored in the right side of the brain, and understood that the details of her getting sick had become linked in her memory and caused her right hemisphere to shift into overdrive. Once Thomas grasped all of this, he knew he needed to help Katie make sense of those emotions by using her left hemisphere, by bringing in logic, putting the events in order, and assigning words to her feelings. The way he did this was by helping her tell a story about what had happened that day so that she could use both sides of her brain together. He told her, "I know you've been having a hard time going to school since you got sick. Let's try to remember the day you felt sick at school. First, we got ready for school, didn't we? Remember, you wanted to wear your red pants. We had waffles with blueberries, and then you brushed your teeth. We got to school and hugged and said goodbye. You started to paint at the activity table, and I waved bye to you. And then what happened after I left?" Katie responded that she got sick. Thomas continued, "Right, and I know that didn't feel good, did it? But then Ms. LaRussa took really good care of you and knew you needed Daddy, so she called me and I came right away. Aren't you lucky to have a teacher that took care of you until Daddy could come? And then what happened? I took care of you, and you felt better." Thomas then emphasized that he came right away and that everything was okay, and he assured Katie that he would always be there anytime she needed him. By putting these narrative details in order like this, Thomas allowed his daughter to begin to make sense of what she was experiencing with her emotions and in her body. He then began to help her create some new associations that school is safe and fun, reminding her of various aspects of her school that she loved. They wrote and illustrated a book together that told the story and featured her favorite places in her classroom. As kids often will, Katie wanted to read her homemade book over and over. Before long, she regained her love of school, and the experience didn't have such power over her anymore. In fact, she learned that she could overcome fear with the support of the people who love her. As Katie grows, her father will continue to help her make sense of her experiences. This storytelling process will become a natural way for her to deal with difficult situations, giving her a powerful tool for dealing with adversity into adulthood and throughout her life. Even children much younger than Katie, as young as 10 to 12 months, respond well to telling stories. For example, imagine a toddler who's fallen down and skinned her knee. Her right brain, which is completely in the present moment and in touch with her body and fear, feels pain. On some level, she worries that the pain may never go away. When the mother retells the story of the fall, putting words and order to the experience, she helps her daughter engage and develop her left brain, explaining what happened. She simply fell down, so that she can understand why she's hurting. Don't underestimate the power of a story to hold a child's attention. Try this if you have a little one. You'll be amazed at how helpful it can be, and how eager he'll be to help tell future stories when he's been hurt or feels afraid. This name-it-to-tame-it technique is just as powerful with older kids. One mother we know, Laura, used it with her son, Jack, who had been in a minor, but still scary, biking accident when he was 10, and felt nervous any time he thought about going out on a bicycle. Here's how she helped him tell the story so that he could begin to understand what was going on inside. Laura, do you remember what happened when you fell? Jack, I was looking at you when we were crossing the street, and I didn't see the grate of the sewer. Laura, and what happened next? Jack, my wheel got caught and the bike fell over on me. Laura, and that was frightening, wasn't it? Jack, yeah, I didn't know what to do. I just went down in the street and I couldn't even see what was happening. Laura, that must have been scary to have something happen out of nowhere. Do you remember what happened next? Laura went on to help Jack recount the whole experience. Together, they discussed how, in the end, the ordeal was resolved by some tears, comforting, band-aids, and bike repairs. Then they talked about watching out for sewer grates and being aware of oncoming traffic, which helped Jack free himself from some of the feelings of helplessness. The details of a conversation like this will obviously change along with the situation. But notice how Laura drew the story out of her son, letting him take an active role in the storytelling process. She acted primarily as a facilitator, helping get the facts of the event straight. This is how stories empower us to move forward and master the moments when we feel out of control. When we can give words to our frightening and painful experiences, when we literally come to terms with them, they often become much less frightening and painful. When we help our children name their pain and their fears, we help them tame them.
Whole Brain Kids. Teach your kids about the two sides of the brain. In this chapter, we gave you several examples of how to help your kids integrate their left and right brain. It can also be helpful to talk to your children and explain to them some basics about the information we've just covered. To help you along, here's a story about the two sides of the brain that you can tell your kids. We've written it with 5 to 9-year-olds in mind, but you should make it your own and adapt it to fit the age and developmental stage of each child. Your left brain and your right brain. Do you know that you have many parts to your brain and they all do different things? It's almost like you have different brains with minds of their own, but we can help them all get along and help one another. Our right brain listens to our body and other parts of our brain and knows about our big feelings, like when we're happy or brave or scared or sad or really mad. It's important that we pay attention to these feelings and talk about them. Sometimes when we're upset and we don't talk about it, our feelings can build and build inside us, like a huge wave that washes over us and makes us say or do things we don't mean. But the left brain can help put our feelings into words. Then our whole brain can work together as a team and we can calm down. For example, Annie got sick and had to miss her friend's birthday party. She was so mad about staying home that a huge anger wave grew and grew and was about to crash down on her. Annie's dad helped her talk about what she was feeling. When she used her words to say how she felt, her left brain helped her surf the big anger wave from her right brain, and she rode it to shore, calm and happy.
Integrating ourselves, connecting our left and right brain. Now that you know more about the left and right sides of the brain, think about your own integration. When it comes to parenting, are you too right brain dominant? Do you frequently get swept up in emotional floods, leaving your children drenched with your own chaos and fear? Or maybe your tendency is to live in a left brain emotional desert, so you are rigid in your reactions and have a hard time reading and responding to your children's emotions and needs. Here are the words of a mom we know who realized that she was primarily interacting with her young son using only one side of her own brain. I was brought up in a military family. Needless to say, I'm not very touchy-feely. I'm a veterinarian and a trained problem solver, which doesn't help me in the empathy department. When my son would cry or become upset, I would try to get him to settle down so I could help him solve the problem. This was not helpful and sometimes exacerbated the crying, so I would walk away and wait until he calmed down. Recently, I learned about trying to connect emotionally first, right brain to right brain, which was totally foreign to me. Now, I hold my son, listen, and even try and help him tell his story using both the left and right brain together. Then we talk about the behavior or solve the problem. Now I try to remember to connect first and solve second. It took some practice, but when I related to my son emotionally first, using my right brain along with my left, instead of using only my left, everything else went more smoothly and our relationship in general improved as well. This mother realized that by ignoring parts of her own right brain, she was missing out on important opportunities to connect with her son and to enhance the development of his right brain. One of the best ways to promote integration in our children is to become better integrated ourselves. We'll discuss this more fully in Chapter 6 when we explain mirror neurons. When right and left brain are integrated, we can approach parenting from both a grounded, left-brained, rational place, one that lets us make important decisions, solve problems, and enforce boundaries, and from a right-brained, emotionally connected place, where we are aware of the feelings and sensations of our bodies and emotions, so we can lovingly respond to our children's needs. Then, we'll be parenting with our whole brain.
Chapter 3. Building the Staircase of the Mind. Integrating the Upstairs and Downstairs Brain. One afternoon, Jill heard yelling and commotion in the bedroom of her 6-year-old, Grant. 4-year-old Gracie had found her brother's treasure box and taken his most rarest crystal, which she then lost. Jill arrived just in time to hear Gracie say in her most spiteful voice, "It's just a dumb rock, and I'm glad I lost it." Jill looked at her young son, fists clenched and face turning red. You've probably experienced just such a moment, where a situation with your child is delicately balanced and is about to turn ugly. Things could still be salvaged and tip toward a good and peaceful resolution, or they could tilt in the other direction, devolving into chaos, anarchy, even violence. And it all depends on your little darling controlling an impulse, calming some big feelings, making a good decision. Yikes! In this case, Jill immediately saw signs of what was coming. Grant was losing control and was not going to make a good decision. She saw the fury in his eyes and heard the beginnings of a barbaric growl begin to emerge from his throat. She matched him step for step as he raced across the few feet between himself and his sister. Fortunately, Jill was quicker and intercepted Grant before he reached Gracie. She picked him up and held him close as his punches and kicks flailed wildly in the air, Grant screaming all the while. When he finally stopped fighting, Jill set him down. Through his tears, he looked at his sister, who actually adored and idolized him, and calmly uttered the phrase, "You're the worst sister in the world." As Jill told me this story, she explained that this last verbal torpedo had hit its mark and produced the dramatic tears from Gracie that Grant had hoped for. Still, Jill was glad that she had been there, or her son likely would have caused physical, not just emotional pain. The question she asked me is one that parents ask us frequently. I can't be with my kids every second of the day. How do I teach them to do the right thing and control themselves, even when I'm not around? One of the most important skills we can teach our kids is to make good decisions in high emotion situations like the one Grant faced here. We want them to pause before acting, to consider consequences, to think about the feelings of others, to make ethical and moral judgments. Sometimes they come through with the kind of behavior that makes us proud, and sometimes they don't. What is it that makes our kids choose their actions so wisely in certain moments and so poorly in others? Why do certain situations leave us patting our children on the back and others leave us throwing our hands in the air? Well, there are some pretty good reasons based on what's going on in the higher and lower parts of a child's brain.
The mental staircase, integrating the upstairs and downstairs brain. We can talk about the brain in many ways. In Chapter 2, we focused on its two hemispheres, the left and the right. Now we want to look at it from top to bottom, or actually, from bottom to top. Imagine that your brain is a house, with both a downstairs and an upstairs. The downstairs brain includes the brainstem and the limbic region, which are located in the lower parts of the brain, from the top of your neck to about the bridge of your nose. Scientists talk about these lower areas as being more primitive because they are responsible for basic functions, like breathing and blinking, for innate reactions and impulses, like fight and flight, and for strong emotions, like anger and fear. Whenever you instinctually flinch because a little league foul ball flies into the stands, your downstairs brain is doing its job. The same goes for when your face goes red with fury because, after 20 minutes of convincing your kindergartner that the dentist's office won't be scary, the dental assistant enters the room and announces in front of your daughter, "We'll need to give her a shot to numb her." Your anger, along with other strong emotions and bodily functions and instincts, springs from your downstairs brain. It's like the first floor of a house where so many of a family's basic needs are met. There, you'll almost always find a kitchen, a dining room, a bathroom, and so on. basic necessities get taken care of downstairs. Your upstairs brain is completely different. It's made up of the cerebral cortex and its various parts, particularly the ones directly behind your forehead, including what's called the middle prefrontal cortex. Unlike your more basic downstairs brain, the upstairs brain is more evolved and can give you a fuller perspective on your world. You might imagine it as a light-filled second-story study or library full of windows and skylights that allow you to see things more clearly. This is where more intricate mental processes take place, like thinking, imagining, and planning. Whereas the downstairs brain is primitive, the upstairs brain is highly sophisticated, controlling some of your most important higher-order and analytical thinking. Because of its sophistication and complexity, it is responsible for producing many of the characteristics we hope to see in our kids: sound decision-making and planning, control over emotions and body, self-understanding, empathy, morality. A child whose upstairs brain is properly functioning will demonstrate some of the most important characteristics of a mature and healthy human being. We're not saying she'll be superhuman or never display childish behavior. But when a child's upstairs brain is working well, she can regulate her emotions, consider consequences, think before acting, and consider how others feel, all of which will help her thrive in different areas of her life, as well as help her family survive day-to-day difficulties. As you might expect, a person's brain works best when the upstairs and downstairs are integrated with each other. So a parent's goal should be to help build and reinforce the metaphorical stairway that connects the child's upper and lower brain so that the two can work as a team. When a fully functioning staircase is in place, the upper and lower parts of the brain are vertically integrated. That means that the upstairs can monitor the actions of the downstairs and help calm the strong reactions, impulses, and emotions that originate there. But vertical integration works in the other direction too, with the downstairs brain and the body, the house's foundation, making important bottom-up contributions. After all, we don't want significant upstairs decisions being made in some sort of vacuum that's devoid of input from our emotions, our instincts, and our bodies. Instead, we need to consider our emotional and physical feelings, which originate downstairs, before using the upstairs to decide on a course of action. Once again, then, integration allows for a free flow between the lower and higher parts of our brain. It helps build the stairway so that all the different parts of our brain can be coordinated and work together as a whole. The unfinished upstairs, setting appropriate expectations for your kids. Even though we will want to help build this metaphorical staircase in our child's brain, there are two important reasons to maintain realistic expectations when it comes to integration. The first is developmental. While the downstairs brain is well developed even at birth, the upstairs brain isn't fully mature until a person reaches his mid-20s. In fact, it's one of the last parts of the brain to develop. The upstairs brain remains under massive construction for the first few years of life. Then, during the teen years, undergoes an extensive remodel that lasts into adulthood. Just imagine the downstairs of a house that is complete and fully furnished. But when you look up at the second floor, you see that it is unfinished and littered with construction tools. You can even see patches of the sky where the roof hasn't been completed yet. That's your child's upstairs brain, a work in progress. This is really important information for parents to understand, because it means that all of the abilities on the list above, the behaviors and skills we want and expect our kids to demonstrate, like sound decision-making, control of their emotions and bodies, empathy, self-understanding, and morality, are dependent on a part of their brain that hasn't fully developed yet. Since the upstairs brain is still under construction, it isn't capable of fully functioning all the time, meaning that it can't be integrated with the downstairs brain and consistently work at its best. As a result, kids are prone to getting trapped downstairs without the use of their upstairs brain, which results in them flying off the handle, making poor decisions, and showing a general lack of empathy and self-understanding. So that's the first reason kids often aren't very good at using the higher and lower parts of their brain together. Their upstairs brain is still developing. The other main reason has to do with one particular part of the downstairs brain, the amygdala.
The baby gate of the mind. My amygdala made me do it. Our amygdala is about the size and shape of an almond and is part of the limbic area, which resides in the downstairs brain. The amygdala's job is to quickly process and express emotions, especially anger and fear. This little mass of gray matter is the watchdog of the brain, remaining always alert for times we might be threatened. When it does sense danger, it can completely take over or hijack the upstairs brain. That's what allows us to act before we think. It's the part of the brain that instructs your arm to stretch out to protect your passenger when you're driving and have to stop short. It's the part of the brain that encourages you to scream stop, as was the case when I was hiking with my young son, even before I was consciously aware that there was a rattlesnake a few feet up the trail. Of course, there are definitely times when it's good to act before thinking. In this situation, the last thing I needed was to have my upstairs brain go through a series of higher order maneuvers or perform some sort of cost-benefit analysis. Oh no, there's a snake up ahead of my son. Now would be a good time to warn him. I wish I had warned him a couple of seconds ago rather than going through the series of cogitations that led me to the decision to warn him. Instead, I needed my downstairs brain, in this case my amygdala, to take over, to do exactly what it did, cause me to call out even before I consciously realized what I was doing. Clearly, acting before thinking is a good thing when we're in a situation like mine, or when we're in danger in some other way. But acting or reacting before we think isn't usually so good in normal, everyday situations, like when we storm from our car and yell at another parent for breaking the no-waiting rule in the carpool pickup circle. As we'll explain in the Whole Brain Kids section to follow, that's what we call flipping our lid. It's how the amygdala can get us into trouble. It takes over and relieves the upstairs brain from its duties. When we're not truly in danger, we want to think before acting, instead of the other way around. We want our kids to do the same. The problem, though, is that, especially in children, the amygdala frequently fires up and blocks the stairway connecting the upstairs and downstairs brain. It's as if a baby gate has been latched at the bottom of the stairs, making the upstairs brain inaccessible. This, of course, further compounds the other problem we just discussed. Not only is the upstairs brain under construction, but even the part of it that can function becomes inaccessible during moments of high emotion or stress. When your 3-year-old erupts in anger because there are no orange popsicles left in the freezer, his downstairs brain, including the brainstem and amygdala, has sprung into action and latched the baby gate. This primitive part of his brain has received an intense surge of energy, leaving him literally unable to act calmly and reasonably. Massive brain resources have rushed to his downstairs brain, leaving little to power his upstairs brain. As a result, no matter how many times you tell him that you have plenty of purple popsicles, which he liked better than orange last time anyway, he's probably not going to listen to reason in this moment. He's much more likely to throw something or yell at anyone nearby. As you know, if you found yourself in this situation, the best way to ease him through this crisis, and in his mind it really is a crisis, is to soothe him and help him shift his attention. You might pick him up and show him something else of interest in another room, or you might do something silly or off the wall to change the dynamics of the situation. When you do this, you are helping him unlatch the gate so that the stairway of integration can once again become accessible and he can engage his upstairs brain and begin to calm down. The same goes for when the problem isn't anger, but fear. Think of an active, athletic 7-year-old who refuses to learn to ride a bike. Her amygdala produces such paralyzing fear that she won't even attempt an activity at which she's more than capable of succeeding. Her amygdala has not only placed a baby gate at the bottom of the stairs, it has littered the stairway with the equivalent of balls, skates, books, and shoes, all kinds of obstacles that come from past frightening experiences and make it impossible to reach the higher parts of her brain. In this situation, there would again be many different possible strategies for clearing the pathway. Her parents might try to persuade her of the reward of taking on a new challenge. They might acknowledge and discuss their own fears. They might even offer an incentive to help her conquer her fear. Any number of approaches might work to help her clear the connection to her upstairs brain and quiet her amygdala, which is shouting the message that she might fall and hurt herself. Think about what this information means practically as we raise kids who don't have constant access to their upstairs brain. It's unrealistic to expect them always to be rational, regulate their emotions, make good decisions, think before acting, and be empathetic. All of the things a developed upstairs brain helps them do. They can demonstrate some of these qualities to varying degrees much of the time, depending on their age. But for the most part, kids just don't have the biological skill set to do so all the time. Sometimes they can use their upstairs brain and sometimes they can't. Just knowing this and adjusting our expectations can help us see that our kids are often doing the best they can with the brain they have. So does that give them a get-out-of-jail-free card? Sorry, Mom, that I squirted our new puppy's face with Windex. I guess my upstairs brain wasn't fully engaged. Hardly. In fact, it actually gives us parents even more incentive to see that our kids develop the faculties that result in appropriate behavior. And it gives us a pretty effective strategy for making some dicey decisions, especially when we're in the middle of a heated situation, like a tantrum. Tantrums, upstairs and downstairs. The dreaded tantrum can be one of the most unpleasant parts of parenting. Whether it takes place in private or in public, it can, in the blink of an eye, turn the person who owns our heart and moves mountains with one beautiful little smile into the most unattractive and repulsive being on the planet. Most parents have been taught that there's only one good way to respond to a tantrum: ignore it. Otherwise, you communicate to your child that she has a powerful weapon to wield against you, and she will wield it over and over again. But what does this new knowledge about the brain say about tantrums? When you know about the upstairs and downstairs brain, you can also see that there are really two different types of tantrums. An upstairs tantrum occurs when a child essentially decides to throw a fit. She makes a conscious choice to act out, to push buttons, and terrorize you until she gets what she wants. Despite her dramatic and seemingly heartfelt pleas, she could instantly stop the tantrum if she wanted to. For instance, if you gave in to her demands or reminded her that she is about to lose a cherished privilege. The reason she can stop is that she is using her upstairs brain at that moment. She is able to control her emotions and body, to be logical and make good decisions. She may look like she's completely out of control as she screams in the middle of the mall, "I want those princess slippers now!" But you can see that she knows what she's doing and that she's definitely working from strategy and manipulation to achieve a desired end. that you drop everything and immediately buy the slippers. A parent who recognizes an upstairs tantrum is left with one clear response. Never negotiate with a terrorist. An upstairs tantrum calls for firm boundaries and a clear discussion about appropriate and inappropriate behavior. A good response in this situation would be to calmly explain, "I understand that you're excited about the slippers, but I don't like the way you're acting. If you don't stop now, you won't get the slippers, and I'll need to cancel your playdate this afternoon because you're showing me that you're not able to handle yourself well." Then it's important to follow through on those consequences if the behavior doesn't stop. By providing this type of firm limit, you're giving your daughter practice at seeing the consequences of her inappropriate actions and at learning to control her impulses. You're teaching her that respectful communication, patience, and delayed gratification pay off, and that contrary behaviors don't. Important lessons for a developing brain. If you refuse to give in to upstairs tantrums, regardless of the age of your child, you'll stop seeing them on a regular basis. Since upstairs tantrums are intentional, children will stop returning to that particular strategy when they learn that it's ineffective, and often even leads to negative results. A downstairs tantrum is completely different. Here, a child becomes so upset that he's no longer able to use his upstairs brain. Your toddler becomes so angry that you poured water on his head to wash his hair that he begins screaming, throwing toys out of the tub, and wildly swinging his fists, trying to hit you. In this case, the lower parts of his brain, in particular his amygdala, take over and hijack his upstairs brain. He's not even close to being in a state of integration. In fact, the stress hormones flooding his little body mean that virtually no part of his higher brain is fully functioning. As a result, he's literally incapable, momentarily at least, of controlling his body or emotions, and of using all of those higher-order thinking skills like considering consequences, solving problems, or considering others' feelings. He's flipped his lid. The baby gate is blocking access to the upstairs, and he simply can't use his whole brain. When you later tell someone that your child totally lost his mind, you'll actually be more neurologically accurate than you realize. When your child is in this state of disintegration and a full-blown downstairs tantrum has erupted, a completely different parental response is called for. Whereas a child throwing an upstairs tantrum needs a parent to quickly set firm boundaries, an appropriate response to a downstairs tantrum is much more nurturing and comforting. As in the connect and redirect technique we discussed in Chapter 2, the first thing a parent needs to do is to connect with the child and help him calm himself down. This can often be accomplished through loving touch and a soothing tone of voice. Or, if he has gone so far that he's in danger of hurting himself or someone else or destroying property, you may have to hold him close and calmly talk him down as you remove him from the scene. You can experiment with different approaches depending on your child's temperament, but what's most important is that you help soothe him and steer him away from the chaos bank of the river. There's no sense in talking about consequences or appropriate behavior. He simply can't process any of that information when he's in the middle of his downstairs tantrum, because that conversation requires a functioning upstairs brain that can listen and assimilate information. So, your first task, when your child's upstairs brain has been hijacked by his downstairs brain, is to help calm his amygdala. Then, once the upstairs brain re-enters the picture, you can begin to respond to the issue using logic and reason. Did you not like it that Daddy washed your hair like that? Do you have any ideas about how we should wash your hair next time? Once he is in a more receptive place, You can also talk about appropriate and inappropriate behavior and about any possible consequences. I know you were really angry about the war.